Hey, good morning, everybody. We're going to be in the Gospel of John this morning. We're going to be in the Gospel of John through most of the rest of the year. This morning, we're in John 19, and so if you have a Bible, way to access your Bible, John 19:23. And we're continuing this series. We're calling this the cross-centered life, and we've been asking the question, what if the cross is not just the message of what Jesus does for us? It's that, for sure. But what if it's also a model of what Jesus wants us to do for him? That as Jesus sacrifices himself and serves other people and surrenders his will to the will of the Father, he's given us an example for us to also embody in our lives and to live out in our lives, the cross-centered life. And we've come to that moment here in John 19. Jesus is now on the cross. He's been nailed to the cross. All the brutality and gruesomeness has taken place. And he's really about to die. And as we look down from the cross, we can see that there are four Roman soldiers, a half-Roman unit. The full Roman unit's called the contubernium. It's eight men. It's how many people you could stick into a tent, in a Roman tent. So that's eight guys goes in there. This half-unit is an execution squad. And they're down there at the base of the cross somewhere, and they've got the men who've been crucified, they've got their clothes and they're sort of dispersing them amongst themselves, and then they get to one thing and they say, this thing is intact, we don't want to tear it, and so they start gambling amongst themselves, you know, rolling dice, to see who gets it. And then from the cross, Jesus will look out, and in front of him are some of the women, all seemingly named Mary. It seems like the only name that you had in the Bible was Mary, because there's all these different Marys, and one of them is his mother. And I think it is in this scene that we finally see what we're talking about today, the real cost of the cross for Jesus. And this morning I want us to just do a little bit of calculation this morning. I want us to do a little counting of the cost of the cross. That's the title of what we're looking at this morning. John D. Rockefeller was one of the richest men, of course, that ever lived. In his time, he was the wealthiest man. And somebody once asked John Rockefeller this kind of interesting question. They said, how much is enough? And John Rockefeller answered in a famous fashion. He said, just a little bit more, right? I mean, just a little bit more. Rockefeller's idea is very much the American way of thinking about this, isn't it? In our culture, we are very interested in more. But the cross is showing us another picture, which is the picture of generosity, the picture of giving, the picture of giving of ourselves. The poet described it like this in a supposed encounter with an angel. But must I keep giving and giving again? Ah, no, said the angel, and her eyes pierced me through. Just give till the master quits giving to you. Well, our moment here is in John chapter 19. And as we're looking at this passage today and we see what Jesus is doing for us, we also see that Jesus is giving us an example of what he wants us to do, living in the shadow of this cross and living this cross-centered life. You might think about it like this. This is maybe another way to think about it. As you come to church and you're here and you're even listening to this, a professor was teaching a classroom of students. And after class, a man walked up to the professor and said, Professor, one of the students in the class came up to me, and I talked to him, and he said, he's one of your students. And the professor said, oh, no, 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 he's not one of my students. He just attends my lectures. And this morning, what I want us to think about through this whole message this morning is are you here today just attending the lecture? Or are you one of the students? Are you here today just kind of listening to this and hearing all of this? Or are you actually somebody who's going to walk out here and say, you know, I'm going to put this into practice in my life. I don't want to just kind of be a Christian in name. I want to really be a disciple of the Lord Jesus. Verse 23. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes. They divided them into four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. This garment was seamless. It was woven in one piece from the top to the bottom. Let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot or by a little Roman dice. And we archaeologists have dug these things up. Let's decide by a lot who will get it. And this happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, this comes from Psalm 22. This afternoon, you might read through Psalm 22 because it is a story before the cross, 1,000 years before the cross, of what happens to Jesus. This happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, they divided my clothes among them and they cast lots for my garment. So this is what the soldiers did. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother. His mother's sister. What do you call your mother's sister? Your aunt, right? Mary, the wife of Clopas. I told you, there's a bunch of Marys there. And Mary Magdalene. Four women right there. When Jesus saw his mother there, it's almost like he didn't even notice it until now. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved, the beloved disciple, we call him John, standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that time on, this disciple took her into her home. I think we finally see in this moment what I'm calling the cost of the cross. And today I want us to count the cost of the cross. By looking at what happened to Jesus, by looking at what Jesus was willing to give up today, I think we see some things that if we're going to do what he did or what he wants us to do, we're going to have to be willing to do. And one of these is the cost of the sacrifice of your possessions in life. You know, it is true that in our culture, it is ordinary for us to say, well, I earned this, this is mine. But it is also true to say that if we are a Christian, we have an understanding that it isn't ours, it belongs to his, and he has a right to ask us to do what he wants us to do with it. I was reading this morning in 2 Timothy, where Paul talks to Timothy, and he says to him, Timothy, he's this young pastor, I give you this charge. He says, if anybody is rich, plousios, they have more than the other people do. He says to them, command those who are rich in this age, and he gives a long list of things that they're to do. And then in the end, he says, be generous. It's interesting that Paul doesn't say to Timothy, ask people to give money. He doesn't say, beg people to give money. He just says, command them. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? That's pretty blunt. The reason that Timothy can do that, the reason that Paul can say that, is because the cost of the cross places a demand on our lives, including our possessions. There's no way of getting around this for Jesus, because at the cross, and we see this literally here, is that the cross, if we're going to follow him too, may take the shirt off your back, quite literally. One of my favorite things to do whenever I get a chance to do is I like to read biographies. And one of my favorite biographies to read are famous preachers, of course. And one of my favorite biographies is Thy Will Be Done, the biography of George W. Truett. Truett was the pastor at First Baptist Church, Dallas. And everyone in this room has been benefited by his ministry, because in his day, he wanted to start this thing called a hospital in Dallas. And he asked some of the people to generously donate, and they started the Baylor Hospital. You ever been to the Baylor Hospital in Waxahachie, anybody? All right, anybody with one in Dallas? Or any Baylor Hospital ever anywhere, or know anybody who has? So, like, he kind of did a big thing in his day. And people kind of gave him a hard time about it. But he did it, and we're all better because of it. But George Truett had a reputation not just of asking people to be generous, but he was generous. And one of the stories that I kept reading in the biography was about how Truett would be walking down the streets of old Dallas when it was not a real big city, but there was a lot of poverty, and there were a lot of people who literally didn't even have shirts on. And he would come up to somebody and say, "Why don't you have a shirt on?" And they would say, "We don't have a shirt." And this is true. George Truett would take his shirt off and put it on one of these people. And they said he would come to church without his shirt on. Yeah, that's kind of funny, you know? I think what Truett was doing was exactly what Jesus was doing. He was realizing that the cross has the right to demand of me to give even of my possessions. And that's what he was willing to do here. Now, in this world, you had all kinds of different clothes you wore. They're not like our clothes today. You wore sandals. There was a belt. There's an outer garment called a hamation. There's an undergarment called a chiton. There's a head covering. All these different things that you wore, and they're gambling not over that. They're just dispersing all those items except for the undergarment. And when they get to the undergarment, the seamless thing from top to bottom, then they start just trying to decide what they're going to do with it. Now this raises a very uncomfortable question, doesn't it? And it's this question. You can't avoid it. Was Jesus clothed at the cross? You know, if you look at the Renaissance art or the European art of the last couple of hundred years, 500 years, 1,000 years, they always portray Jesus sort of with something on. But when the Romans crucified you, they crucified you without any clothes. That was part of they stripped you of your dignity. In the Roman world, what you wore indicated who you were. And the more layers and styles that you wore indicated you were of a higher noble class. The slave wore their undergarments. So you could tell who a person was and what kind of respect you were supposed to have for them depending on their clothes. And to be stripped even of your undergarments meant that you were lower than the slaves, which is what the point of the cross was to do to Jesus. Now, as I look at that this morning, I think to myself, Jesus knew that he was going to do that. He was willing to give up his dignity, his propriety. He was willing to sacrifice not just his life, but everything for us, even the clothes off of his back. And to me, the message just rings clear. The cross absolutely demands our generosity. You know, it doesn't leave any wiggle room there. It demands our generosity. Jesus is always talking about this, and sometimes we don't even notice it. His most famous parables are the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is a story about generosity, isn't it? And then his other most famous parable is the story we call the story of the prodigal son, or the lost son. But when Jesus tells the story in Luke 15, it isn't about the son. As Jesus says, it's about the father. He says there was a man, he was a dad, and he had two sons. The story is the story of a father who had two sons. One of the sons said, hey, give me the wealth. He gives him half of it, and he runs away. He's wasted all, and he comes home. And what does the father do? Does the father rake him over the coals and say, you knucklehead, you know, get out of my sight? No, what the father does is he puts on this fancy robe on him, a gold ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and then gives orders to kill literally the most valuable animal they own, the fatted calf, which obviously outrages the elder brother who sees all of this as wasteful. That's what the word prodigal means. The prodigal son story is not a story about a prodigal son. It is a story about a prodigal father who continually gives generously. And Jesus is trying to get us to understand something. This is what God has done for you. This is what Jesus is doing for you at the cross. But he's not just doing it for you, he's giving you an example. Now, this is bad, right? But it gets worse. Because not only does Jesus give up his possessions, he gives up what I would call his quality of life, and as it relates to us today, that means your quality of life. We often say, we don't mind death, we just don't want to die, right? We don't want to go through the long process that leads to death. Hey, if I'm going to die, let it be quick, right? That's what we often say. We don't want to go through that long laboring process. In fact, we'll even say this, if I lose the quality of my life, go ahead and let me go. Because why? We value the quality of our life even more than life itself. And here's the thing about Jesus, is Jesus is not only willing to die on the cross, he is willing to give up the quality of life at the cross. And that's an incredible sacrifice. And now let me just put it to you like this. If you and I are going to live the cross-centered life, it may take you out of your comfort zone. I learned this the hard way. This week I got to go to my alma mater, East Texas Baptist University, where I went to school back in 1998. That was 20 years ago. It's kind of crazy to think that long ago. It's hard to imagine that I'm that old. Right after ETBU, I graduated in 2000, I went to seminary at Baylor at Truett. But before I started taking seminary classes, I became a pastor. I got hired at a church in Waco, and I'd gotten these letters in the mail. They were looking for pastors. Six different churches were asking me to be a pastor at the same time. And so I put it in an order of responsibility, and the church that had the least responsibilities, I said, that's God's will for my life right there, you know? All they wanted was someone to preach on Sunday morning. Nothing else, they said. Never believed that, by the way. So I signed up, and I came out there. I preached a few sermons, a few Sundays, and then one day the phone rang. And I thought, who's calling me? Who's bothering me from this church, you know? They called me on the phone, and they said, so-and-so is in the hospital. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I'll pray for them. Why are you telling me? What do you expect me to do about it? Well, aren't you going to go and see them? You mean in a hospital? Like, me go to the hospital? I don't do hospitals. I mean, that's where sick people are, you know? The only people that go to hospitals are people that are sick. Why would you want me to go there? I might get sick too. I might even die. You know, I'm not going to go to a hospital. They're dirty. I mean, have you been in a hospital? What is this? Why are you calling me? I'm just preaching on Sunday morning. And there I see myself walking into a hospital as a pastor for the first time and being in a room surrounded by people and a man whose life is about to leave this earth. It was the most uncomfortable moment of my life. Since then, I've discovered much more uncomfortable things. But what I've discovered along the way is that if I'm going to follow the cross in my life, it is going to take me out of my comfort zone. But I've also discovered that in all of those moments where I'm out of my comfort zone, God is able to use me in those moments to do incredible things for Him. And I want to challenge you today to realize that as God pushes you out of your comfort zone, that He may be just getting you ready to use you in some profound and powerful way. And so they took away the garments, and they sat there at the foot of the cross, and they're casting lots. Who's going to get it? I always wonder which Roman soldier got the garment. What's the deal with this garment anyway, this woven one-piece garment? What's the big deal about it? There's been movies made about it. Did you know that? There's this movie called The Robe, which, by the way, is completely not true, historically inaccurate, and misses the whole point of this scene. But it's a really good movie if you haven't seen it. just being honest. What a lot of people think is they think, well, Jesus was wearing this and they were gambling over it because it must have been expensive. So let's just ask that question. Was this expensive? Is that what this story is about? This was some really pricey thing Jesus had on, this really nice undergarment. Is that what this is about? The answer is no. It's not about the richness of the garment. It is actually about its religious purpose. And even here at the cross, Jesus is still following the law. In the Old Testament, there's a really strange commandment that says, this is Leviticus 19:19, keep my decrees. Do not mate different kinds of animals. Do not plant your field with two kinds of seed. And do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material. I never thought I was going to read that in a sermon, by the way. That's just one of those strange parts of the Old Testament. But one of the things in that passage says, do not put together two different kinds of clothing. Jewish people, then and now, who are devout in their Orthodox Judaism, will not wear as their undergarment a fabric made of more than one material. They will not wear a polyester and cotton blend. Not because it's not comfortable, but because it's against their legal requirements. Now, they'll wear their outer garments made of other materials, but not their undergarments. So this undergarment was made of one material to ensure that it was of religious function. But there's another possible reason. The person in antiquity, known for having worn one of these, in the Jewish world, was the high priest. And if you dig around in your Bible studies, you'll discover that there's significance because perhaps John is reminding us that Jesus was wearing this as to remind us that he was also going to the cross to take our place as our high priest for us. Now, regardless, you ever hear a preacher say, if you don't hear anything else I say today, hear this, right? Well, if you don't hear anything else I have to say, here is this. And this is going to be tough, but it's the truth. The cross shows us that genuine generosity happens when our giving affects our lifestyle. That when our level of giving begins to hurt. Now, put this in perspective, right? I have in my office a few things hanging on bookshelves and this kind of stuff. And one of the statistics I have that just sits there, and it sat there for 3 years when George Barna first released it after doing all his research, it just sits there, you know, and I just look at it from time to time. But I've never shared it in a sermon. And it's the Barna research where in 2015 he asked the American Christians, how do you give money? How much do you give? And on this little piece of paper in my office, it says that 25% of Christians gave in 2015 less than $50. Less than $50. 54% of Christians gave less than $500. So if you put those two numbers together, 80% of Christians who name the name Christ, who the cross of Jesus Christ they recognize was the ultimate sacrifice for their sin in which the Son of God gave up everything, including literally the clothes on his back for them, gave less than $500. Now, all that sounds bad until you get to this, and then it sounds worse. 77% said they were, quote, satisfied with their level of giving. I told you last week that 93% of Ellis County is not in church today and is not any Sunday this year. I heard Craig Groeschel say this week, Craig's one of the pastors of the fastest growing churches in America. Craig was talking about this and he said, you know, how in the world does the church in America think that the church is going to take on the kingdom of darkness when we have this level of generosity? Like, how are we going to reach the 93% in our community if we're not willing to do what we're supposed to do in terms of generosity? Maybe if we were willing to do what we were supposed to do, we would have the tools to accomplish that. The cross shows us that genuine generosity happens when our giving begins to affect our lifestyle. I think that for most people, giving less than $500 a year is not getting into their lifestyle, right? Jesus illustrates this point in the most powerful and poignant way in Luke 21. He's watching as everyone goes in and out of the temple. You all know the story well. He watches as the wealthy patrons of the temple come in and they deposit their large sums of money, and then the widow walks in with her mite and deposits it, and then Jesus says, she's given more than anyone, and then explains why. Because she has given, he says, all that she has. She has given to the point where it's hurting her. Like, there's not going to be bread on the table tonight. If the church in America would begin to give to the point that it affects our lifestyle, it affects the kind of car that we drive, the kind of house that we live in, the kind of clothes that we wear, the kind of trips that we take, maybe the church would have the tools it needs to make the kind of impact in the world that we need to have. One of my favorite stories is in the last chapter of the book of 2 Samuel. And it's a story of David's life. David sinned. There's a big discovery. Seems like all he ever did was sin and write psalms about it. And you get to the last chapter. Thank you for laughing at that. You get all the way to the last chapter of the... it sounds like a country music. You know, he's like perfect for country music. You get all the way to the last chapter of 2 Samuel. And David realizes he has goofed up big time, and he's going to make a sacrifice to God to get it right. And so he goes and he's going to buy this piece of land, and he's going to buy the animals, and he's going to make the sacrifice. And the guy's like, "You're the king. Take it. It's yours. You just have it." And then David says something so famous to me, so important to me, so impactful in my own life. He says, "No, I will not come before the Lord my God and bring him an offering that costs me nothing. It's going to cost me. It's going to affect my life. I'm going to feel it. And when I feel it, I'm going to remember the nails. I'm going to feel it, and I'm going to remember the stripes. I'm going to feel it, and I'm going to remember him who was wounded for me and broken for me and crucified for me. I'm going to identify with him. I'm going to live this cross-centered life, because the cross shows us genuine generosity happens when our giving affects our lifestyle." Now, all that's bad, right? You're like, "This is tough. Can we just finish now?" It gets worse. Because as Jesus looks out from the cross, who does he see? He sees his mom. He sees another person that we're told here, maybe it's Salome. If it's Salome, then it's Jesus's own aunt and the parents of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. So John that's there would actually be his cousin. And he's looking out at the cross, and what we see in this moment is the third thing here, is that if we're going to count the cost today of the cross for our lives as well as for Jesus, is it costs his family, it costs us, your family, costs me my family. Our families are going to pay some of the price of this cost. Now, we've talked about the cost that Jesus gave up. He gave up his clothes, he gave up his dignity, he gave up his life, he gave up his quality of life, but this one is different. From the cross, he looks out, and at the cross, you know who Jesus gave up? He gave up his mother. He gave up his mom. The only mother that he had ever had, right? He gives up at the cross. He's willing to give up at the cross his mom. This is adoption language, official Roman and Jewish adoption language. He says to his mom, "This is your son," and to the son, "This disciple, this is your mom." He literally gives away his mother at the cross. If we're going to understand the cost of the cross today, we have to understand this. Now, what's the lesson here? Well, I mean, where are we getting at? This kind of sounds strange or weird. Well, here's the point. God is more important than your family. Now, I know people who don't agree with that. I know people who say, no, family is the most important thing in the world, and something about blood and rivers and water and all that kind of weird stuff. But if God is not more important than your family, then your family is your God. So, I mean, we have to decide which one is it. How is it going to work? In Jesus' ministry, Mark chapter 3, there was a whole group of people he's teaching them. And the religious leaders are there, and his followers are there. And then his parents come, his family comes, and they're trying to get Jesus. They kind of think he's starting to lose it a little bit. They want to get him out of there. And the crowd tells, "Hey, Jesus, your family's here. They're here to get you." And he says, "Well, who's my family? Who are my mother and my brothers?" And he looked at the people seated around him in a circle and said, "Here is my mother, and here are my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and my sister and my mother." And at the cross, Jesus himself did that, didn't he? At the cross, Jesus showed that obeying God was even more important than his love and loyalty to his own earthly family. That's an incredible sacrifice. It's an incredible gift that he gives up there at the cross. So let me ask you this in reverse. What did Jesus' family have to pay? I mean, how many times did Joseph get a story about, what really happened in Nazareth? What, all the travels they made in their life. And then finally at the end, Mary looking up, and as it says in Luke's gospel, her heart was pierced that she would have to give up her son, her firstborn. How many times was Mary that, even that week, thinking, maybe this week he's going to be made the king of Israel? How many times did she see him do a miracle and go, wow, he really is the Son of God. What's God going to do? Some great thing. And then hours later, she sees him hanging, suspended on a cross, bruised and brutalized and naked. For her, they paid a huge price. The message is simple, profound, powerful, and it ought to be life-changing. God must be the most important thing in your life. Jesus said that countless times. And I've been trying to say it today. Are we here for a lecture, or are we here to become his students? Are we here to just hear the message, or are we here to have our life changed by it? Jesus said this again and again in the Gospels as the cost of discipleship. Luke 14, 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate father, mother, wife, and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. The word meseo in Greek, to hate, is a Semitic idiom. It doesn't mean that you're literally supposed to hate your family. It means that your love for God is so intense and so great that in comparison, your love for everyone else and everything else pales in comparison. Your loyalty and love of God is demonstrated in such a profound way that in comparison, everything else doesn't even begin to compare. I want to pray for you.